Chapter 6 Crypto Wars. A conference room inside the sprawling Stanford University campus in Northern California was an inconspicuous place for the opening salvo of a war, and the combatants sitting across the table in 1976 were not exactly the type you would normally find on a battlefield. On one side were a pair of 20-something West Coast-based researchers, Martin Hellman and Whitfield Diffie. Diffie's long hair was just one sign that the two were definitely part of the 1970s and not part of the establishment. On the other side were three men in suits who had come over from the East Coast. Two came from the NSA. The other said he came from the National Bureau of Standards, but in fact had just transferred from the NSA. The most senior of the NSA men, technically retired but still very much involved, was Arthur Levinson. More than 30 years before, he had been one of the select Americans who had worked at Bletchley Park during the Second World War. He had gone on to become one of America's leading codebreakers, running A Group, which targeted the Soviet Union, and most recently the Machine Processing Organization, which ran the NSA's computers. The NSA had ballooned in size, not just to deal with the Soviets, but also to support the ill-fated military campaign in Vietnam. But now the American national security elite were on the defensive. There had been the disaster of Vietnam, with Saigon falling the previous year to the communists. There had been the Church Committee raising fears of what the spies might be up to at home. And Washington as a whole was reeling from the Watergate scandal that had forced President Nixon from the White House after his abuse of institutions had been revealed. A lot of people outside the secret world had come to the conclusion that power was not to be trusted. And sitting across the table from Levinson and his NSA colleagues were a pair of young upstarts determined to lay siege to the NSA's innermost secrets. That morning session at Stanford was recorded on cassette tape by Paul Barron, the RAND analyst who had worked on packet switching concepts more than a decade earlier. The young academics asked if they could, and NSA offered no objection. "It's appropriate that they approve their own wiretapping," joked Diffie. On the tape, the scratch of chalk is audible as Hellman goes into battle by writing up numbers on a blackboard to make his case. At dispute that day was the seemingly obscure topic of whether a proposed government encryption standard had been made deliberately too weak. The argument began with maths, but really it was about much more. It was the start of a 40-year war which continues to the present between the state and computer experts about privacy and national security. There was a culture clash at that meeting, not only between the uptight East Coast suits, the men in black, and the West Coast hippie academics, but also over ideology. To the NSA, cryptography was their domain, vital in protecting the country, and had to be kept secret. And now, suddenly, these two outsiders were asking questions, causing trouble and endangering national security. Diffie and Hellman saw themselves as fighting the NSA's presumed monopoly because they believed people, and not just the state, had the right to a high degree of privacy and security for their communications. "My view at the time was I was Luke Skywalker in Star Wars," Hellman admits, "and NSA was Darth Vader." In other words, he was the hero who was going to take on the might of the evil empire almost single-handed. At stake was an issue that was going to become a defining one for security in the computer age and the source of intense friction between spies and the outside world. How secure was information going to be on computers, and could the state be trusted to secure it? The meeting at Stanford was the beginning of a struggle over encryption that is still gathering pace 40 years later. For centuries, diplomats, generals, and spies had worried about keeping their secrets, but it was less of a concern for everybody else. By the 1970s, however, computers had moved out of the basement of the NSA and were becoming more common in government use. They were holding more and more information in one place in the form of databases. Some of this was sensitive, but not what was traditionally thought of as secret or highly classified data, for instance, people's tax and health records. The private sector was also increasingly holding sensitive information on computers it wanted to protect. The obvious answer was for the near-magical power of encryption to move outside the secret realm where it had resided. In the late 1960s, a naturalized German engineer for IBM called Horst Feistel came up with a computer key generator to encrypt data used in government databases. This would be a physical device with a computer program in it which would generate a key to scramble a message, a kind of electronic version of a mechanical Enigma machine. It was christened Lucifer, a strange tribute to its power, perhaps. At first, there had been no interest, but then the first computer stepped forward. As with the Enigma machine, it was a bank. Lloyds Bank in London was building a network of cash machines that would spew out money after a computer contacted another to validate the request. It was obviously important to be sure that this process was secure, otherwise it would be a magnet for thieves. Previous commercial ciphers had proved easy to crack. In 1963, Donald Davis of the NPL in Teddington had broken the first magnetic stripe card for an ATM in a matter of hours. IBM realized a lot was riding on Lucifer when it came to public and commercial confidence, as well as the reputation of the company. To test their key, they asked a team of people to see if they could break it. This was one of the earliest cases of commercial white hat hacking, or penetration testing, asking someone to test whether you are as secure as you hope you are. After 7 weeks of trying, the hackers failed to get into Lucifer. Next up was the NSA. It could see that as IBM and others wrestled with ways to break this code, they were inevitably moving towards forbidden territory, the techniques it used to attack foreign encryption systems which it considered its deepest secrets. The NSA wanted to ensure it had some control over the process, and so suggested that it both test Lucifer to make sure it was secure and oversee its distribution. It was a way of keeping control. A few lines in a government publication called The Federal Register in March 1975 announced that a regulatory body called the National Bureau of Standards, NBS, now called NIST, was going to set a new encryption standard for the government to secure its information. This was theoretically open to competition. The victor would inevitably become the default security standard for the wider world, including business. IBM would be the only real candidate, and so discussions began about adapting Lucifer. This is where Whit Diffie and Martin Hellman entered the fray. Hellman was one of the tiny band of people outside government who had become fascinated with cryptography. His colleagues told him he was mad to work in that field, but he persisted. He had worked with Feistel briefly at IBM before going to Stanford in 1971. He had grown up in the Bronx, but California offered more freedom. At conferences, people with badges suggesting they worked for the U.S. government would ask him if he was interested in doing some consulting for them. But when he asked if he would be free to publish, and they said no, he decided he did not want to work for what was clearly the NSA. There was a bit of him that relished the challenge of taking on the big guys as well. At Stanford, a colleague had recommended he talk to another young man who shared his fascination. When he met Whit Diffie, Martin Hellman immediately knew he had found an intellectual soulmate. With his long hair and immaculately tailored London suits, Diffie is a free-thinking, idiosyncratic character who in many ways epitomized the countercultural challenge to the establishment. Conventional academic work had not suited him, but he had ended up at MIT working on computer programming in the 1960s. In part, he was looking at the issues Alan Turing had studied, how to define intelligence in machines. But while doing his research on computers, he became interested in how to keep his own information private, partly the result of games played between fellow computer researchers who tried to find out what each other was doing. This was the fundamental impulse behind encryption, stopping other people prying into your data. But details of the way in which codes could do that were a kind of forbidden knowledge kept in the confines of the secret world, out of reach of ordinary mortals. That intrigued, but also angered, Diffie. Diffie and Hellman's first meeting went on for hours as they headed back to Hellman's house to keep talking late into the night. The two men could see that the growing marriage of computers, data, and communication brought with it the need for the average citizen to protect information like medical and banking records. The U.S. was the most computerized country in the world. It had the most to lose by insecure computer encryption. When the NBS issued details of the proposed Federal Data Encryption Standard, DES, a modified version of Lucifer, Hellman and Diffie began poring over the details. They thought they saw something fishy. First of all, the design of the S-box, which housed the mathematical algorithm to encode the data, was secret. They started wondering whether there was something the government did not want people to see. A relative had told Hellman that the NSA had secretly colonized the NBS. It seemed to the young Stanford men as if this dark, secret, malevolent force was working behind the scenes in the shadows. Could they have installed a trap door in the new system for their own ends? We came up with the idea of trap doors from the Hardy Boys or other mystery books I'd read as a kid, Hellman says, citing a series of children's adventure novels. There was some tomb I think they were stuck in with a million bricks, and if you press on the right brick, a door opens and you'll survive. Otherwise, you die of thirst in this tomb. The designer knows which brick to push and can survive. To anyone else, the room would look secure, but the person who knows where the trapdoor is simply has to open it to get in. There was something else, though, which was much more obvious. The strength of the encryption seemed much lower than it needed to be. The original Lucifer key was 128 bits. The version being proposed had been reduced much further, first down to 64, and now to 56 bits. A way to think about 56-bit encryption is to imagine 56 switches, each of which could be on or off. That may not sound like a lot, but the possible permutations are 2 to the power of 56, which comes out at 70 quadrillion. An increase of 1 bit doubles the strength, so a 57-bit code, not a 112-bit code, is double the strength of a 56-bit code. So choosing a 56-bit code made it a lot weaker than a 64-bit code, let alone a 128-bit code. Why? 70 quadrillion still sounds like a lot, but Diffie and Hellman thought that the way computers were heading, they would be able to cycle through those possibilities in a realistic time frame by doing a brute force attack. That might not be possible for criminals yet, but Diffie and Hellman thought computing power was growing so fast that it might not be long before they could. And someone with a lot of supercomputers in their basement might be able to break such a code right now. Who could that be? Everyone suspected, but few knew for sure, that the NSA had built hugely powerful cryptanalytic computers to do just that kind of calculation. So that morning at Stanford, Hellman laid straight in. "The first thing we'd like to hit is the key size of the proposed standard," he told the suits. "We feel it's too small, both today we feel it's vulnerable to attack by an agency such as NSA, although quite secure against commercial assault, and we feel that looking 15 years down the line and extrapolating the decreasing cost of computation, the standard would be insecure against attack by almost anyone." The meeting began politely, but that did not last long. Levinson is a Brooklyn boy and Marty is a Bronx guy, Diffie recalls of how his colleague began to get riled by the men in suits. There were two abrasive upfront New York personalities. They tried to brush off his, Hellman's, analysis, saying this is amateur incompetence. That was what started the fight. Hellman said it might eventually be possible to break the key with brute force in a day. Levinson countered that it would take 91 years. Hellman said that was rubbish. The two New York men started to go at each other. It became clear that as well as worrying about a weak key being vulnerable to all kinds of people in the future as computing power improved, Hellman was saying he was worried about the NSA as a threat right now. The political and cultural context had changed since the days of the Second World War and early Cold War. In the wake of Shamrock and Watergate, a new generation saw the government as not necessarily the protector of the people and their liberty, but a potential threat to those liberties. American culture was changing in profound ways, and Diffie and Hellman shared an anti-authoritarian outlook. "You think NSA today is looking at anybody's income taxes?" asks Levinson incredulously. "Honestly, we don't think so, but that's in the climate of Watergate. We think that's something we hardly take for granted," Hellman replies. The row intensifies as the argument moves from the maths to the politics. "I spend my career there, and I never read anybody's income tax return," the NSA man Levinson exclaims. Hellman interrupts him. "But if there's a request from the executive branch to do that, what would you do?" he asks. "If the executive branch comes and tells me as a civil servant to shoot Marty Hellman, I don't know what I'd do," Levinson retorts as a joke. "You would," exclaims Hellman, to laughter. There was a trade-off over national security. Both sides agreed. A balance between being able to crack codes and securing information. "We feel we've struck that balance," argues Levinson. "Here's the deal," replies Hellman. "I don't think that the National Security Agency is the appropriate organ of the government to decide where that balance lies." The question of whether the NSA was best placed to judge the balance between offense and defense was a key question then and remains one now. As the meeting came to an end, Hellman suggests the NSA is his enemy. For Levinson, a man who sees himself as having worked to protect his country from the dark days of the Second World War through the Cold War, this questioning of his patriotism is too much. "I feel a little funny that you regard me as an enemy," he replies. Hellman says that is not quite right, but Levinson persists. "Well, that's what you're saying. The NSA is the enemy." "Not you specifically," Hellman replies, not backing away from the idea that the NSA as a whole is a potential enemy. At that point, the meeting is concluded and the tape switched off. Hellman saw himself at the time as a self-appointed security officer for the public, taking on the NSA on their behalf, but is more reflective now. "My view back then was they were not interested in national security. They were interested in job security. Now I look at it very differently. I do think they were concerned. They had some legitimate concerns, and I should have taken those into account. I still would have taken the position that I did, but I would have fought it more fairly. Now, they didn't fight fairly either. In fact, they fought less fairly. They were telling me I was wrong when I was right." Former NSA and NBS officials from the time are still sensitive about the whole affair 4 decades on and choose their words carefully when they speak about it. They say the secrecy around the S-Box design was not because of a trap door, but actually to protect a specific code-breaking technique known as differential cryptanalysis, which the outside world had not yet discovered. Most critics now accept there was not a trapdoor. However, the reduced key size remains more mysterious and suspicious. Former officials say it had to be reduced to fit on a single commercially produced chip to make it practicable. In other words, it had to be good crypto, but also cheap enough crypto. They also say that since it was for US use only and not for export, making it too strong was not so much of an issue. But the key sections covering DES remain blacked out in a recently declassified NSA official history. And that history makes it clear there was an internal disagreement leading to a compromise on 56-bit, which suggests some people might have wanted it even weaker. Within the NSA, the decision to get involved with the federal standard had been contentious. Both the NSA and GCHQ have a dual mission: to gather intelligence from communications of adversaries, but also to protect their own country's communications from those adversaries. This had been a lesson learnt the hard way in the Second World War. If you knew what you could do to your enemy, you could stop them doing similar things to you, and vice versa. The relationship between these two functions was fairly straightforward for many years. Your enemy used a machine like Enigma that you tried to unlock, while learning from this process to make your equivalent machine as secure as possible. But what if both your people and your adversaries started using the same encryption techniques? How weak or strong did you want it? This new emerging world of encryption posed a challenge, because the system you were securing was one that the public and not just the government might be using, and which could also spread internationally. Did you want a system used by your own public that might be totally secure for them, if that meant those abroad you were trying to spy on would also use it and be secure themselves? Offense and defense were previously complementary. Now there was an inherent tension. Some, like the Second World War veteran Frank Rowlett, had always argued that in the long run it was more important to secure your own communications than to exploit those of the enemy, but the NSA and GCHQ still saw themselves primarily as intelligence-producing agencies. An official report into the controversy said the key size was more than adequate for all commercial applications for which the DES was intended over the intended time span. The phrase was very carefully chosen. The system was designed so that it was secure enough to keep criminals and states out, apart from those with the highest level of capability. That meant the NSA and, unfortunately, also the Soviet Union. Making a code uncrackable to the Soviets would have the unfortunate byproduct of also keeping the NSA out. And that was not what was wanted. DES was used for many years for everything from banking to police communications in the US, and by the early 1990s it had become the most widely used encryption algorithm in the world, an NSA official history remarks. Though technically restricted to the US, it was used in 33 countries, a rather useful outcome if you know you can break it. Diffie and Hellman lost that first battle. Looking back, they both now agreed the standard was not as bad as they feared. But at the time, this tactical defeat in the opening battle would strangely lead to the two men's much more important strategic victory against their opponent. After that morning at Stanford, they were fired up. The two began reflecting on how to secure information from the prying eyes of the state. If DES was weak, then maybe they could find something stronger. They began thinking about the trap doors, the type they feared were hidden in the chip. Diffie had a radical idea. What if there was a way of using the concept to provide security rather than vulnerability? One night, he came up with an answer. If you could put a secure trap door in your own message, then it could be scrambled as much as you like, and only you would know how to get back in and read it. So what if, rather than using the same key to lock and unlock a message, you had two keys, one which was public and which you gave to anyone who wanted to send you a message, This would be used to scramble the message. But then there was a second private key that you kept yourself, the trapdoor key, which was the only way of unscrambling a message. This was utterly revolutionary. When Hellman explained the idea to Horst Feistel at IBM, he said it was absurd. The whole trick of encryption, as everyone had known for centuries, was to keep your keys secret. So the two German operators using an Enigma machine would both need to use the same key to lock and unlock a message. But this was hard work. The central problem of encryption for centuries had been key distribution. To share a secret with someone, you both needed the same key. But how do you distribute that key secretly in the first place? One-time pads might be secure, but getting a single pad to both sender and recipient totally securely was hard work. Even swapping Enigma or Tunny settings was difficult in wartime, or if you worked across the world. Changing keys regularly was also laborious. What was called public key offered a different model. For Diffie, the motivation had also been ideological, part of his distrust of authority. "I started all of this with a very anti-establishment viewpoint," he explains. "I never understood what's called a key distribution center, which is a pre-public key technique for distributing keys, because it involves trusting a central organization center. Public key meant you did not need to courier a key secretly. Everyone who wanted to send a message to you could use the same published key. This also meant you could change it much more easily. With an Enigma machine, you needed to keep the workings of the machine secret as well as the key. But if the public were going to use cryptography, then keeping the machine secret was clearly not possible. The secrecy had to reside in the key, not the machine. Public key was going to offer encryption to the masses, and not just the state. It also offered another benefit. It meant you could authenticate a message. People had been wondering how you could prove who sent a message in the digital world when it consisted of ones and zeros which could be manipulated. A signature worked in person, but not electronically. If I was to agree a contract, remotely and electronically, how would you know I would not back out later claiming it had been faked? With public key, you could scramble a message with your private key and then send it to someone else. They could then use your public key to read it. In doing so, they would know for sure that the message had come from you, as only the combination of the two keys would make the message readable. This made it the digital equivalent of a signature. The system opened up the possibility of contractual exchange and commerce in a digital world. At the time, this seemed abstract, but internet commerce today would be impossible without these two advances. If you wanted to send payment to a bank securely, could you really wait for a courier to deliver an electronic key every time? And how would the bank know it was you and not someone else manipulating ones and zeros to give your name? The modern world of secure electronic communications is built in no small part on what is known as public key cryptography. In turn, this is based on the breakthrough known as the Diffie-Hellman key exchange. When the two men published a paper entitled New Directions in Cryptography, most of the world, as it had done with Alan Turing's On Computable Numbers, did not quite grasp what was being proposed. Diffie and Hellman's paper found its way to the academic Ron Rivest at MIT. Along with two colleagues, Leonard Adelman and Adi Shamir, he began working on applications for public key. In technical terms, what was needed to make a trapdoor was a mathematical one-way function, something that was very easy to do one way but nigh impossible to reverse. Multiplying two large, randomly chosen prime numbers proved the breakthrough, since it is almost impossible to work out which two numbers have been used if you are presented with the product. They published an article in Scientific American that made a huge stir, not least because it offered $100 to anyone who could crack a message. Out of the three men's work would come the company bearing their initials, RSA, still a major force in the computer security world. But just as importantly, out of the magazine article came a flood of letters from the public. A revolution was underway. Cryptography was going public. The old era of secret code making and breaking was dying. Thousands of miles away in Britain, one mathematician could be forgiven for feeling rather frustrated as he read the article in Scientific American. "I thought, gosh, yes, I've seen this before," Clifford Cox recalls with a wry smile. He had seen it before because he had also developed the same mathematical scheme as RSA, but a few years earlier, and he had to watch as the rest of the world lauded this new discovery which he had in fact worked out in his first few months in his office. The problem for Cox was that his office was GCHQ, and that meant his work had all been utterly secret. Cox had joined GCHQ as a young mathematician in 1973 after a university tutor at Oxford had suggested he might be interested in some fascinating but rather secret work, the fabled tap on the shoulder, which was always known to operate for MI6, but also applied to mathematicians for its sister agency. On starting, Cox had been presented with a range of mathematical problems. One in particular caught his eye. It was something that a colleague, James Ellis, had been working on. Ellis, born in Australia but brought up in London's East End, was, like Whit Diffie, mildly eccentric but also brilliant. He had found a home for his talents at GCHQ. James was something of a maverick. If he was given a problem, he would never try and solve it directly, says Cox. In the 1960s, the agency was struggling with distributing the vast number of encryption keys used by the armed forces. As things like secure telephones were being pushed to more and more people, the strain of developing and distributing a growing number of keys securely was becoming immense. Was there a way of overcoming the need to courier these around the world securely so that both sides would have the same key? A Second World War report into secure speech provided a burst of inspiration for Ellis. A 1944 paper suggested that the person who wanted to receive a message could send out seemingly random noise. The person sending the message would then add their voice message to the random noise they had received and send it back. Anyone intercepting the message would only hear the combination of the two noises. Only the person who had put the random noise on in the first place would know what it was and be able to take it off and hear the message they had been sent. The key concept was that the recipient, not just the sender, took part in the encryption process. Ellis says that one night in bed in 1969, he came up with a theoretical proof for what he called non-secret encryption, in which someone added a random key to a digital message which only they would know how to remove. Another analogy was the idea of sending someone a box with the padlock open. They put the message in and closed the lock. They never needed the actual key, and nor did the courier, who could not open it on the way since only the sender had the key. He was then faced with the challenge of making it work in practice and finding a mathematical function to generate the right type of key. For a few years, Ellis was stuck. Within GCHQ, this was viewed as an interesting challenge, but not a top priority. One camp thought it could not possibly work, and it was just that no one had figured out why. Another camp thought it might work, but could not see how. When the maths team introduced their 22-year-old new recruit to the puzzle, Clifford Cox was intrigued. By a stroke of luck, he had been working on number theory. "I just happened to be the right person in the right place at the right time," he says modestly. What that meant was that the very night he was told about the problem, he had the solution. "I thought of it that night, I wasn't able to write anything down, as you weren't allowed to write anything down, so I just hoped that when I went to sleep I would remember it when I woke up in the morning. Cox realized that multiplying two large prime numbers would be easy to do one way, but hard to reverse. Just as Ellis had come up with something almost identical to the Diffie-Hellman concept, although without the idea of a digital signature, now Cox had come up with his version of the RSA solution. The next morning, having fortunately not forgotten it, he wrote it up and took it to his boss. "This is the most important cryptographic discovery of the century," Cox's boss exclaimed, and ran off down the corridor. Another colleague, Malcolm Williamson, would also come up with a further innovation, but among the top brass at GCHQ there was nervousness about this idea. It just seemed wrong, too easy, too different to what had been done before. There had to be a flaw, one which could then be exploited like a back door by the Russians. Within the secret world, investing in such a scheme involved too much risk, some thought. The technology was also not quite there yet to be able to build such devices cheaply, and so the idea remained just that. A few years later, the British team began to hear about a revolution coming out of America, and they had to bite their lips and remain silent. Williamson talked about trying to get the US patents blocked, but he was told not to bother. And so, despite having technically come up with the idea, or a very similar one, first, the British team had to sit and watch as all the credit, the glory, and the money went to the Americans, who began to develop public key systems. Britain and GCHQ had missed a huge opportunity to be pioneers. When Clifford Cox was asked whether he was frustrated by this, there was a telling pause before a careful answer. "I just thought of it as something I had done, and I had moved on, and that was just how life was." Ellis had been frustrated by the lack of recognition, and wrote a paper to try and set the record straight, but this paper itself was then classified. He tried year after year to get it cleared by GCHQ. Finally, it was released in December 1997. James Ellis had died a month earlier. Secrecy has a price. In the summer of 1976, Whit Diffie went to see Arthur Levinson of the NSA, one of his opponents at the Stanford meeting. Diffie told him about the key exchange theory. At the time, Diffie was surprised by the fact that Levinson was not overcome with awe at the originality of the theory. Looking back now, Diffie believes it was because the NSA already knew about it. This may be because the NSA had been told of the work at GCHQ, or it may be, as some former NSA officials suggest, that they themselves had also come up with a form of public key exchange in secret. Since the first murmurings of new work on codes outside the US, the NSA had reacted with a mixture of panic and denial. Surely everyone who wanted to work on codes would want to do so inside the NSA. Concern really began to escalate with the publication of the Scientific American article and the realization that a lot of people were starting to get interested in the field. This needed to be stopped. NSA hunted diligently for a way to stop cryptography from going public, records a declassified official history of the agency. For the NSA, public key was a nightmare. They might be able to beat something like a 56-bit DES key with their supercomputers working away on the permutations for a while, but if the key could be changed every day, then no sooner would they break into a code than it would be gone. And the fear was that everyone would be able to use this system. In 1977, one of the more influential directors of the NSA took the helm. Bobby Ray Inman was the son of a Texas gas station owner. He was something of an outsider, not from the traditional Navy elite, and also unusual in that he had always wanted to be director of the NSA. He was a workaholic with a photographic memory who started work at 4 a.m. In his 80s, he starts at 5 a.m. He immersed himself deeply in the technical aspects of the business and worked with an intensity that left his staff often unable to keep up. He appeared perpetually calm, but in reality was about as stable as high voltage across an air gap, an NSA historian noted. Inman had a distaste for human intelligence and also for commercial espionage, both of which he viewed as somehow unclean. It was on his watch that a rule was laid down: no use of the intelligence machinery for the advancement of the commercial interests of American companies. Before that, intelligence had been passed to companies, but Inman insisted, over objections, that it be stopped. President Carter had been hostile to the work of the entire intelligence community, including the NSA. But when White House officials realized the cost in not renewing the successor to Shamrock, they changed their stance. Inman also finally won a long-running battle with the CIA over their attempts to muscle in on signals intelligence. His approach gained him much-needed allies in Congress. But it was the battle over cryptography that caused some of his biggest headaches. His staff were seriously worried. First of all, he inherited the mistrust over DES. The NSA was actually engaging in a highly complex balancing act in working out how secure to make non-classified communications, Inman argues. The aim was to make it secure enough that most other states could not break it, but not so strong that, if it was exported, the NSA itself would not be able to get into it. Export was the real fear for it. Finding the balance, Inman explains, you wanted it strong enough that it could not be broken easily. And now public key raised even more challenges. Again, the fears that staff expressed to the new director were about export. The great worry was that this effort would produce cryptographic systems that they couldn't break, and it wasn't just worry about drug dealers and the rest of that. It was that they could be picked up by foreign countries, and that they could reach a level of encryption that NSA would be unable to successfully attack. The day Inman took the reins, one member of staff took events into his own hands by picking up his pen. In July 1977, a letter arrived at the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, a prestigious computing body. It raised concerns over cryptography research and drew attention to specific paragraphs in the International Traffic in Arms Regulation Code that made exporting certain military technologies illegal. It sounded like a warning, and it soon emerged that the author worked for the NSA. Inman would later recall ruefully that it had been sent without him knowing anything about it and not as official policy. However, the perception grew that the NSA was going to fight against the new ideas. Academic grants to people working on cryptology were questioned. Secrecy orders were put out on people trying to patent new encryption technology. But this again led to the thing the NSA hated most: press reports. Martin Hellman received darker warnings. Silicon Valley is sometimes called Spook Valley because not only is silicon made here, but there is a huge presence here by the intelligence community, he explains. And some of my friends in Spook Valley told me I was stepping on some very dangerous toes. And by the way, I wasn't just stepping on NSA's toes. I was stepping on GCHQ's toes. I was stepping on the KGB GRU's toes. And so they warned me that not only was I potentially going to suffer legal action, but my life might be in danger. Codes suddenly looked dangerous, but also kind of sexy and anti-authoritarian. So, how to respond? Some in the agency said the best thing would be to take the usual NSA position and say absolutely nothing. They argued that any public discussion of cryptography would heighten awareness and lead other countries, especially in the developing world, to buy more secure devices than the weak ones NSA was regularly penetrating. Others talked of getting new legislation passed to increase government controls. At first, Inman pursued this path, seeking a new law, but there was no appetite for it in Congress, And so a third option was taken by default, to talk. Inman decided to deal direct. While on the West Coast, he arranged a parley. Since I was already on the West Coast, I decided to drive down to Stamford and get acquainted with Professor Marty Hellman, Inman recalled with a chuckle decades later. I think he was somewhat surprised, maybe impressed, that Muhammad had come to the mountain. Decades later, too, Hellman would recall the events, starting with a phone call. I get this call and it says Admiral Inman is coming to the Bay Area and would like to meet with you if that's possible. So here I've got Darth Vader in mind, at least in my mind at the time, wants to meet with me. But of course I didn't know, being Luke Skywalker, that he was actually, in some sense, my father. But I said I'd be happy to, and we met in my office here at Stanford. And I'll never forget, his first words jokingly were, "It's nice to see you don't have horns," because that's what he was getting from everybody at NSA, and from their perspective. And so I looked back at Admiral Inman and I said, "Same here," because they'd seemed like the devil to me. Out of this unusual meeting came something of a dialogue. A group of academics, including Hellman, agreed a voluntary system in which they could submit planned papers to the NSA, who would explain if there were any sensitive issues. However, there was no veto over publication. Part of it was persuading the counterculture types that we, in fact, did not have evil intent, Inman says of his initiative, and that we genuinely were focused on national security. How you protect it. And we made the presumption that, notwithstanding their political views might be different, they still were patriotic. Inman did something else unusual for an NSA director. He spoke in public. In front of a friendly audience of private sector contractors in early 1979, he argued that collecting secret intelligence required secrecy in order to protect intelligence sources of the utmost fragility and sensitivity. The NSA had until recently enjoyed the luxury of relative obscurity, but wider interest in the security of communications had led to a novel encounter between the NSA and the outside world, which had not been a happy one. Inman acknowledged that, as more information was being held on computers, people worried that it was vulnerable to being stolen or accessed in an unauthorized fashion. The public has become increasingly aware of the danger that automated data processing systems, if not adequately protected, can be exploited for fraudulent and illegal purposes. Moreover, the vast amount of personal information stored in and handled by automated data systems, both private and governmental, has given rise to serious concerns about individual privacy. But there was a tension between the intelligence and national security interests of government on the one hand and the public and private sector on the other, he told the audience. If it was not resolved, Inman argued, there was a risk of serious damage to national security. There is a very real and critical danger that unrestrained public discussion of cryptologic matters will seriously damage the ability of the government to conduct signals intelligence and the ability of this government to protect national security information from hostile exploitation. These were the dark warnings spoken by spies from the Second World War to the present. Any discussion was dangerous. The world might go dark. Inman's speech was half a warning to the outside world and half an acknowledgement that the two sides were going to have to talk. Looking back now, just as Hellman can see the other side of the argument, Inman too acknowledges public key was not the end of the world. At the time, the NSA ended up realizing it could not stifle academic interest in cryptography. Free speech was too strong a principle, and people wanted their information secure. The NSA could not stop cryptography, but it could try to control it. There was another problem, though. For Americans to use these systems was just about tolerable, But what if the technology was exported? Export was the big issue. But the concern was not the Soviet Union. It would always be building its own systems that the agency was still struggling to deal with. In practice, it was other, less advanced countries which often provided the best intelligence on the Soviet Union. One of the things the NSA had learned was that by listening to traffic from allies of the USSR, you could find out a lot about the main enemy. For instance, arms exports, or who was visiting where or planning what. You may not be able to get the Soviet traffic, but you could get what was happening on the other end and get understanding, Immon explains. The fear was that now these countries would adopt more secure systems, which would deny a valuable stream of intelligence. With computers and information spreading, people sensed there was money to be made in security. After early struggles, RSA began to sell its product. Companies like Lotus Notes began to use encryption in their product, in which employees collaborated over a network. The NSA and others in government worked on companies to ensure exported systems were weaker, so the Lotus Notes system sold abroad had only a 32-bit encryption standard. In Britain, companies were also pressed only to export weaker versions of cryptography. They would be visited by GCHQ and told, "You will be wanting this," when it came to a particular encryption algorithm. "Not really," the company might reply, noting it was weaker. "Yes, you will, if you want to export," was the reply, as a person involved at the time remembers. One bank got into trouble when it was discovered it had shipped a strong domestic crypto system to a branch in Moscow. How far did the US go in ensuring they could break commercial systems used abroad? Over the decades, whispers have occasionally surfaced out of the spy world that the US has placed back doors in exported commercial products. This, it was said, was based on a mixture of appeals for patriotism and commercial self-interest to the companies, including the fear of not getting export approvals in the future. It is not unheard of for NSA to offer preferential export treatment to a company if it builds a backdoor into its equipment, one person with long experience was reported as saying soon after the end of the Cold War. "I've seen it. I've been in the room." There was also talk of efforts to weaken encryption systems built by foreign companies, tampering with the algorithms so they were either weak enough to break or had a trap door which could be exploited, or a combination of the two. Engineers at foreign companies talked in hushed tones of mysterious visits by unnamed figures, which led to subtle changes. Those companies have always strongly denied the allegations. The likelihood is that NSA teams ensured that weaknesses were left in export versions which only they knew about, and would allow someone who knew the right statistical or cryptanalytic attack to break in. A new set of combatants stepped onto the battlefield of the crypto wars in the latter part of the 1980s. Joining the academics and the businessmen arrayed against the NSA were a ragtag militia of privacy activists who raised the banner of encryption as an ideological cause. Hellman and Diffie had been influenced by the culture of the 1970s, but this new generation took it a step further. A leading figure was Phil Zimmerman. Zimmerman's work intersected two transformative trends. One was a belief in privacy as a means of empowering people against the state. The other was the arrival of the personal computer. As a 10-year-old in Florida, Zimmerman read one of those children's books on codes and secret writing that taught you how to make invisible ink out of lemon juice. By the time he was at university, he learned how to have the same result in masking your communications by writing computer code. He would also read the 1977 Scientific American article outlining how public key might work. Zimmerman was from the post-Watergate generation that was deeply suspicious of government. He was a leading anti-nuclear campaigner and saw cryptography as a means to empower fellow activists to protect their secrets from the government. And by the early 1980s, personal computers were also just emerging, which might allow ordinary people to do that. Zimmerman wanted to spread cryptography to the masses. In his bedroom, he wrote a system modestly called Pretty Good Privacy, or PGP, which for the first time made encryption relatively easy for anyone. Previously, it was controlled through hardware, a physical machine that someone needed to buy and whose distribution could be regulated by a company or the government. But now encryption was moving into the realm of software, a set of instructions that could easily be distributed, perhaps on a disk or even downloaded from the internet. That meant that when PGP arrived in 1991, it scared the hell out of the government. The FBI had come to rely on wiretaps of criminals, for instance, organized crime groups like the Mafia. Suddenly, they worried encryption could put that at risk. They began to lobby hard, holding briefings with government officials, issuing terrifying warnings of what would happen if they went dark. Senator Joe Biden proposed legislation to ensure the government could access unencrypted communications. This possibility in turn created uproar in the crypto community. "I suggest you begin to stock up on crypto gear while you can still get it," one person warned his fellow believers on an internet bulletin board. The language is redolent of what you hear from gun owners and lobby groups when gun control legislation is proposed. "Load up on guns before the government takes them away." The analogy is imperfect, but still illuminating, since there is a strong libertarian streak to the crypto community. The state is perceived as the threat to individual freedom, and it is the patriotic duty of the individual to limit its power. Resistance is seen as heroic. In America, there is a type of revolutionary idealistic zeal to many of the crypto advocates. Zimmerman had a motto: "When crypto is outlawed, only outlaws will have crypto." It was the Wild West out there, and everyone should have a gun in the form of crypto, or at least, to be more accurate, the means to defend themselves. Zimmerman took the danger posed by legislation seriously and started to push out his PGP software before it could be passed. He decided to release PGP for free, telling people to distribute it far and wide by placing it on servers to be downloaded. And they did. And, of course, not just from within the US, but around the world. PGP was killing the system of export control on cryptography. Biden ended up withdrawing the clause from the bill, but PGP was now out there, much to the annoyance of the commercial companies hoping to sell their products. Zimmerman himself began to feel the heat. Some officials from US Customs got in touch. The reason it was customs men who initially came to see Zimmerman was that cryptography had been designated by the US as a munition, exporting it abroad being the equivalent of being an international arms dealer. Zimmerman was put under criminal investigation for 3 years, although never charged. It was a miserable experience at the time, but looking back, he recognizes it as the moment that made his career. The press coverage enhanced PGP's popularity. Zimmerman began to get messages from activists around the world who explained that PGP had become a vital tool for them to communicate and organize while protecting themselves against authoritarian or repressive regimes. A culture was growing up of people who valued privacy and saw the state as the enemy. "What do I have to hide?" Tim May, one of the key ideologues, asked rhetorically. "None of your business," was his response. At its extreme, the crypto community extended from libertarianism into out-and-out anarchism, and a desire actually to destroy the state altogether, seeing it as the enemy of freedom. A few advocates saw crypto as offering the chance to challenge the whole power structure of society and to empower individuals. The cyberpunks had arrived. This was the description used for themselves by activists who were evangelical about spreading cryptography. They were a spin-off from a wider cyberpunk movement which focused on the power of computers and the internet. The playful aspect of early hacking was now being joined by an ideology. Information should be free, some activists argued, believing everything should be open and there should be no secrets. Others said privacy was a fundamental political right. Those two ideas are sometimes expressed in the same breath, but are far from easy to reconcile. When people entered the online space, they did not have to say who they were and could even create a false identity or profile. Because of the way the internet had been established, the only thing that might trace you was an internet protocol address where data would come and go, but this did not necessarily associate with an individual name and could also be masked. People like David Chaum looked at ways of trying to ensure anonymity in communications. This meant going beyond just encrypting the content of a message and actually being able to hide who was sending it, perhaps by remailing it around a network so that the point of origin was hidden. This was useful for all kinds of people. These included those who simply wanted to post abusive messages, but also those seeking to hide from spies, activists, libertarians, whistleblowers, and of course, sometimes spies themselves, for whom multiple identities and working undercover are an essential part of their trade. If you were a dissident living in fear of a knock on the door from the authorities, anonymous communication might be all that stood between you and a dark prison cell, or even death. The U.S. Naval Research Laboratory helped develop a system called Tor, the Onion Router, to provide a means for people living under repressive regimes to communicate and organize without fear. But as with any technology, anonymity can be used for good or for ill. One internet forum created something called the Assassination Politics Plan, in which people could anonymously place bets on the timing of the death of important people. The implicit idea was that if a large enough pool of cash existed, it would create an incentive for someone to carry out the act themselves in order to claim the pot of money. Such a site would only be possible with anonymity. The same tools that would protect people from being imprisoned by their government could offer a safe haven for those with darker purposes. That duality was at the heart of the internet and a contest between its supporters and the state. The cyberpunk ideology spread not just in the US, but around the world, to a hacker community that could speak to each other and form a virtual community on the new technology of internet bulletin boards, making hackers perhaps the second virtual community, after spies. These message forums would be filled with a mix of technological tricks and personal abuse, but also carried, for some, a political edge. An Australian hacker who went by the name of Mendax was one of the earliest people to sign up on the cypherpunk mailing list in the early 1990s. He equated the battle for cryptography with the right to bear arms to prevent totalitarianism. His real name was Julian Assange. As a young man, he lived and breathed computers. Like many others, he was most comfortable and felt he was who he was supposed to be when he was online. He hacked into NASA and Lockheed Martin in the early 1990s, doing no damage but exploring. For him, encryption in those days was something almost mystical. The universe believes in encryption. It is easier to encrypt information than it is to decrypt it. We saw we could use this strange property to create the laws of a new world, to abstract away our new platonic realm from its base underpinnings of satellites, undersea cables, and their controllers, to fortify our space behind a cryptographic veil. A world in which people could communicate and organize anonymously without fear of government was the cypherpunk's dream, but the authorities' nightmare. They saw their intelligence targets become some of the early adopters of the new technology. Previously, only states could encrypt, and only the best, like the Russians, could do it at a high level. But now, Inman says, They began to see international drugs dealers encrypt their voice communications. When Stuart Baker was brought into the NSA as general counsel in the early 1990s, the head of the agency, Mike McConnell, sent another member of staff to brief him on the crypto problem. He handed me a bottle of aspirin and said, "After this briefing, you're going to need them all." Encryption was spreading faster and faster. It turns out that the biggest, most enthusiastic market for strong encryption are people who have a lot to hide. So as soon as you start making new forms of encryption, especially stronger forms of encryption, available, you find that they are misused by criminals and foreign spies and the like, Baker recalls. One NSA expert, Clint Brooks, came up with what he thought was a solution. It was called the Clipper chip. It could be put in phones and potentially other devices to provide secure, encrypted communication, something the general public did not have at the time. But the keys to unlock it would be held by a third party in escrow, and they could be retrieved by the authorities when they got permission, for instance, a search warrant from a judge. This was a back door, but not a secret one, a public one. Stuart Baker wrote an article in Wired magazine extolling the virtue of Clipper and attacking what he called romantic high-tech anarchism. Baker attacked the spread of PGP. Some argue that widespread availability of this encryption will help Latvian freedom fighters today and American freedom fighters tomorrow. Well, not quite, Baker wrote. Rather, one of the earliest users of PGP was a high-tech pedophile in Santa Clara, California. He used PGP to encrypt files that, police suspect, include a diary of his contacts. There might be kids who needed help, but Baker quoted a policeman saying, "Thanks to the encryption, we'll never reach them." Now familiar battle lines were being drawn between privacy activists on one side and authorities talking about criminals and pedophiles on the other. Little would change about the terms of this debate in the years to come. The FBI wanted guaranteed access. They made sure they had that to phones which were not encrypted. The Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act of 1994 ensured all phone companies would build in the facility to intercept communications on the production of a warrant, effectively a kind of back door for law enforcement in the network. But the problem was that this kind of system did not exist to deal with the two emerging worlds of internet communications and encryption. In the 1990s battlefield of the crypto wars, the NSA would suffer a painful defeat over Clipper chip. It inspired a fierce counterattack from the privacy community. It was not helped when an outsider called Matt Blaze spotted some potentially serious security vulnerabilities in the system. NSA veterans admit they made mistakes too, including not letting the FBI lead the charge. They also say they failed to explain to people that Clipper could actually have provided more security for everyone against other people listening in by deploying encryption and leaving only the government with the possibility of getting in. But this ignores the fact that critics saw the government as the problem. Could they be trusted with the keys? This was the Big Brother chip, they said. Those activists also had a new ally who had just taken to the battlefield. The burgeoning tech community did not like Clipper chip at all. They had a strong West Coast anti-government libertarian streak. They believed they were the future and government was the past. The idea that technology promised to liberate the individual became a staple of Silicon Valley culture. For a while, the punks and businessmen would be allies. Many of the new corporations were started by people who came up through the hacker culture, like Steve Jobs, who rejected suits and ties. It was an alliance of convenience which would not last forever, though. The businessmen were motivated by money as well as ideology in rejecting encryption and state control. How were they going to export new technologies around the world with a US government back door in them, they asked. This was a major problem the government had not really addressed. If you shipped technology with encryption to the French, did you keep the key or did you give it to the French government? European countries did not like the idea anyway, as it meant the Americans might have the key. And what about less savory governments who might want to spy in an oppressive way on their citizens? One person described the mess as the Bosnia of telecommunications, a reference to the unfolding disaster in the Balkans at the time. The business lobbyists from Silicon Valley were emerging as a new force. The Cold War is over, they said. The world is globalizing, they argued. Did the government really want America to lose its edge and its exports due to this whole encryption nonsense? Who were these spies anyway, and did we really need them? For the cypherpunks, cyberspace was a place where they lived, not just a tool to communicate. It was a new frontier, which, like the West in the America of the 19th century, offered those heading that way freedom from the past and from authority. A leading group battling for privacy rights online would even call itself the Electronic Frontier Foundation. This new frontier was a place where you could go for a variety of motives, to be free from the strictures of traditional authority, to escape the past, and also to try to strike gold and get rich. The latter applied to the tech industry, where new fortunes would be made, as with the barons of the industrializing 19th century who had built the railroads and struck oil. But the Internet was a frontier that business drove into and colonized, not just in America, but around the world. The notion of globalization was intimately bound up with the spread of the web. Like the telegraph more than a century before, it promised to draw the world closer together, make it easier for people to talk and trade, to create a global village. Tech utopianism was often disdainful of the state and its spies, and believed that they were leftover relics of the past whose importance would quickly fade. That did not quite turn out to be the case. For spies and governments, this spread of commercial technology, whether hardware, software, or encryption, was making the balance between defending your own systems and getting inside your opponents much trickier. If you were using commercial systems, did you want them to be totally secure? Yes, to protect your own communications, but what if your targets were using them? Was it more important to secure them or be able to break them? If you spotted a weakness, did you close it or keep it open? In the NSA, this was called the equities problem, and a board was created to try to resolve the tensions. Security was about more than just scrambling a message with code. One former NSA director recalls an old crypto hand walking into his office soon after he took over. "You know you were responsible for the integrity of the U.S. command and control system," the mathematician said to his new boss. That was the system that gave the orders from the president downwards for the launch of nuclear weapons. He then turned to the door. "Before you leave, let's talk through this," the director replied. "What's the most important thing about encryption?" asked the mathematician. "Scrambled text," his boss replied, thinking that stopping the other side reading the message was the main point of encryption. "Wrong," the visitor said. "The single most important thing is attribution. Only one person can give the order to fire nuclear weapons, the president. So you have to know it is him and not someone else." "What's the second most important thing about encryption?" he asked. "Scrambled text," the director said again. "No, it's the integrity of the data. If the message is somehow corrupted and you get a digit wrong, you could send a nuclear missile against the wrong target." "How many of these do we have to go through?" the director asked. 5, the man replied. "Third one is non-repudiation. If you did it, you can't repudiate that you did it and say it was not you who gave the order," the crypto man explained. 4th, scrambled text? Wrong. Infinity. This is now called availability. The system has to keep working in the same way for infinity or always be available. It cannot go down. Fifth? Asked the visitor. Scrambled text for secrecy, the director replied. You got it, he said. This was the level of assurance and security demanded by government for its most important communications. It had to offer confidence as well as confidentiality. And as the world would move online, the public and people, like banks, wanted assurance too. Security was about more than just secrecy. If health records telling doctors your blood group are going to be kept in a database or online, then security is a concern. But if you were rushed to hospital after an accident, being sure of the integrity of those records and that the blood group is correct and could not have been willfully or accidentally altered, and the availability of those records so the system is always there for a doctor to refer to, are likely to be even higher in your priority list. Providing this in the world of the internet might require encryption, but even that was not always enough to deal with issues of attribution, knowing who sent a message. Because of the many pathways the internet offered for obscuring identity and maintaining anonymity. People liked the anonymous nature of the internet for some purposes, web browsing perhaps, but it was not always practical for others, like buying things or banking. By the late 1990s, the internet was arriving for ordinary people as companies emerged who would allow you to do things like buy a book on the web. Life was moving online, and with it piles of data from people and about people. Everyone would want this secured. The general public were starting to ask questions about security and vulnerability that in the past only the generals and then the banks had asked. Encryption was moving center stage. In 1997, Robert Morris, a computer expert who had recently retired from the NSA, gave a talk to MIT students about protecting information. Morris advised the students not to even think about using email for financial transactions, since it was not encrypted. When asked what the most secure way to send a message was, Morris had an answer: probably the US mail. His take on information security might have seemed alarmist to the students, but it reflected time spent in the world of spies. If people think I see wires and mics everywhere, it's because I do, he told them. To protect information, one has to be paranoid. He explained the tensions over the NSA helping secure information and still being able to break it, acknowledging that the same argument the National Rifle Association made about gun control might apply, that government regulation only stopped ordinary people protecting themselves. The spread of the internet and the debate over encryption reached the highest levels of the Clinton administration in the late 1990s. The new president, and especially his vice president, Al Gore, made a big play of being from a new, technologically aware generation in favor of building an information superhighway. So what was it supposed to do with the internet? The US government had been a key sponsor and had retained controls at various levels, including over encryption and things like the domain names which people used for websites. But now many thought it was time to let go. The first tech boom was beginning. Companies were taking over. People were starting to buy and sell things online. Globalization was in vogue. Security threats had receded since the end of the Cold War. The consensus was emerging that the best thing the US government could do was to deregulate and leave American companies to get rich, and for the internet to spread peace, freedom, and prosperity around the world, as many predicted it would. This letting go ranged from setting up an arm's-length body to distribute global internet address names to relaxing encryption controls. The theory was, at the end of the day, in terms of economic growth, in terms of our ability to spread democracy around the world, which ultimately is the guarantee of our national security, It was better to let it go, said James Lewis, an official involved in the discussions at the time. The debate over encryption was particularly tough and raged for years within the administration between the national security people, like the head of the FBI and NSA, in one corner, and the business commerce-facing officials in the other. Eventually, though, even the most senior intelligence officials could see they were losing. The decision was that it was better for the American economy and national security if you let people make their networks more secure and created a safe environment through online commerce through encryption. Intelligence gathering was not over, it would just have to find new ways of working. Making money was the priority, but allied to an ideology that technology would aid globalization and bring peace and harmony, and therefore security. The U.S. Internet policy is still largely a creature of the 1990s and the beliefs of the decline of the state and of a global economy. It all turned out to be wrong. You know, the triumph of market democracy was nice while it lasted, but it's very much a creature of the California culture of the 1970s and 1980s, and then the Washington foreign policies of the 1990s, argues Lewis. And so, by the end of the 1990s, not only was clipper chip dead, but export controls on cryptography were being lifted. And so the ragtag rebel alliance had defeated the empire and blown up the Death Star. The crypto wars were over. Weren't they? Back in 1976, at that meeting at Stanford, there had been an afternoon session that had not been recorded. It was even more candid than the heated opening meeting. At one point, Diffie spoke with Arthur Levinson about what the spread of encryption meant for the future of communications, or signals intelligence. I went through what I thought was the economics of the matter. Roughly speaking, encryption was falling in cost, and the value of using it was rising, and so at some point signals intelligence would go away, Diffie told the NSA veteran. Whit, we've heard these arguments before, Levinson, whose memory stretched back to Bletchley Park, replied. After World War II, people said people know how to make good rotor machines and business would dry up. They had been wrong, Levinson told Diffie. It had not turned out that way in the end. 40 years on, as Diffie recalls the conversation, he shakes his head with a rueful smile. I was clearly mistaken, he says. Utterly. Diffie slowly came to understand a central paradox that does much to explain the last 70 years of the battle between securing and exploiting communications. The sources are fragile when it comes to signals intelligence, he says, but the phenomenon is robust. In other words, code breakers are always fighting to keep up with new technologies and devices and new means of securing communications in the form of encryption, but even as they lose their fragile hold on some of those sources, they still manage to gather intelligence. Why? It took me a while to realize that the growth of communications has outrun the protection of communications for all human history, Diffie explains. If you were to write out a mathematical expression for the value of signals intelligence, the first term is how much the opponents are communicating. In other words, intelligence collection remained robust because, even as specific sources became easier or harder to read, the number of people communicating was rising, and the amount each individual communicated was likewise growing as part of an information revolution that was only just beginning in the 1970s. In the years after Diffie's conversation with Levinson, the volume of information that was out there in the ether began to grow faster and faster, like an exploding star. And as that happened, people began to understand for the first time that in this new world, they were under attack. Robert Morris would be one of the first to understand that, thanks to a painful lesson.